This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Our institutions fail just as the first waves of a broken climate arrive. We get that story and the resistance from our first guest, Stuart Scott. Then we explore the latest science about a feedback from thawing Arctic permafrost. Our second guest is European scientist Thomas Gasser. I am your scout, Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. He is supposed to be retired living in Hawaii, but Stuart Scott creates Climate Matters TV with scientists like Dr. James Hansen. He travels to climate meetings, where he often sets up alternative panels of scientists and experts, and they are deeply concerned about our future. Now Stuart is heading up a drive to get out what is the second world scientist warning to humanity, and we'll find out what that is. Stuart, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you very much, Alex, for having me again.
So, in November of 2017, here on Radio EcoShock, Dr. William or Bill Ripple from Oregon State University explained the simple beginnings of the second scientist warning to humanity. But wow, that article that was published in a journal, Bioscience, it just blew up, and it did ripple around the world, didn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it did. I believe it holds a record for the number of scientists who signed a paper at publication. And it's gone on from that 15,000 plus to have an additional 8,000 or so. So it's gotten a very wide acknowledgement distribution. It's opened a lot of eyes, hopefully, and hopefully will continue. That's the work we're doing. I was trying to continue to use it to open people's eyes.
And Bill started a group called Alliance of World Scientists, and I gather that you think, hey, this shouldn't be just scientists. Everybody in the world has to take part in this. So tell us about your new project and website.
Well, let me go back just to how that got started. When I, another person familiar to you, Paul Beckwith, introduced me to Bill Ripple and what they were doing. And so I wrote on over and asked Bill if he would distribute to his mailing list another initiative I was involved in, the Nobel Peace Prize and for the sustainable development field. And he did. I was a little bit surprised, but they felt it was enough in line with what they were doing, and they distributed it to their membership. And then something hit me that there was a very important stakeholder left out of what they were doing, and that is the public. Public in terms of individuals and in terms of organizations. And so I asked permission from Bill and the steering committee that he heads to be allowed to do a public-oriented website called scientistswarning.org, where we would basically invite the public to endorse the World Scientists Warning to Humanity Second Notice, and thereby become part of a what I was calling a global constituency for change. And it's gone on from there.
America has two or three television channels devoted exclusively to Donald Trump and lately Judge Kavanaugh. And yet, if I start asking people on the street, I'm willing to bet you, Stuart, that most have not even heard that tens of thousands of scientists have warned them that the future is in extreme danger. How does that work?
How does that not work is the question. I today am in Washington, D.C., and I spent the day on Capitol Hill, and I came back from that in a kind of dejected state. Not despair quite, but I met with the senator from where I live in Hawaii, Mazie Hirono. I met with her this morning, and when she asked me why I was there, and I told her, I gave her the fire hose elevator pitch and raised her eyebrows some. And then I came back later in the day to meet with her aide, who handles environmental issues. And he basically schooled me in the reality of life in the political environment of Washington, D.C. And I was reminded of something Al Gore once said, that when he was vice president, he realized it was a huge abyss between the maximum demanded by the science and the minimum that could be achieved in the political arena. And there's no way that politics can approach the problem. It's just DOA, familiar enough with people who watch TV, dead on arrival. We are not, that's the reason for my dejection, we are not going to deal with this in time. Now, until now, I've been kind of reluctant to acknowledge that, but at least the United States government is not going to deal with it in time. The only thing I can hold out is that reality tends to move in non-linear fashion, and certain times there are jumps, either jumps up or jumps down, depending upon your perspective, and we may have some sort of jump in the panic level or the activism level of society when the full impact of the ecological stressors we've unleashed come back to haunt us.
I generally agree with you in both cases that we're not acting in time, that our best goal now is to search for a less bad future. But, you know, you're talking about Washington, D.C. Now, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change prepares a summary for national politicians attending conferences which may decide our future. But now British scientists say that report for national governments has been seriously watered down. They make the world future appear less risky than we know it is. So what do you expect to happen this December, Stuart, at the so-called COP24 in Poland?
I expect the can to be kicked down the road a few years more. I don't really have a great expectation for the COP. When I first started going to these conference of party meetings annually, I had hope, and then I gradually came to realize that they were political theater. Again, the politicians don't want their feet held too close to the fire, so they set up the rules. I think the scientists are sincere, but I think they set up the rules that the best scientists can do is come up with watered down results. So I don't hold much faith in what will happen. The reason I continue to go is because the work I do, which would require tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars of equipment and skilled personnel in making these Climate Matters TV programs, is available for me for free just by showing up. And so this year I'm going to be co-branding the press conferences that I do at the UN Climate Talks. And they will be both climatematters.tv and scientistswarning.tv. And I'll point both to the same YouTube channel, and we'll mix the programs up, whether they focus on climate more or less exclusively, or whether we go to the wider group of ecological stressors that humanity is pursuing.
I know that there are millions of people out there who don't understand the situation. They think maybe we'll just have to accept a human planet. Maybe we'll all just live online, or we'll replace those natural systems with technology and bioengineering or something. That unreality about how much we totally depend on things like coral reefs and the Amazon and all the natural systems around us, that seems to be the wall that we have to unbuild.
Well, yes, that wall probably will come down naturally. Of course, it'll come down naturally by the result of collapse of the functioning of the system. When the planet gets too hot to grow food reliably in the mid-latitudes, the question then is how soon that will happen. But what you're hinting at there is a huge divide that happened increasingly somewhere along the line when we took ourselves out of nature, out of interaction with the natural world, and put ourselves in what I like to repeat slowly, apartments. That is, we live in little boxes which set us apart. They're not togetherments. They're not neighborhoods. They're apartments. And so we were set apart from one another and set apart from the natural world. Maybe we get a little postage stamp of greenery out front. And that has kind of taken us away from a recognition of the fact that we depend upon nature. I once heard it said that kids no longer understand that food comes from farms. To kids, food comes from the grocery store or the supermarket. Even worse, comes from Costco in the United States. I'm not sure if they have Costco in Canada.
Oh, yes.
But we are divorced at our own peril. We have divorced ourselves from the natural world. I also tell a story sometimes about this electric vehicle trip I took across the United States with a group that was trying to popularize the electric vehicles. We had one Nissan Leaf when they were fairly new and one Zero motorcycle and half a dozen electric scooters and one electric bike, you know, electric-assisted bike. We all made it across, 44-day transit. And in a lunch stop in Arkansas, a heavyset woman comes walking over to the table we're at and say, are you fellas with that van out there? And so I said, yes, we are. And how can we help you? She said she was from the weekly down the street and wanted to know if we'd allow ourselves to be interviewed. So I said, sure. And when the interview was done, I asked her, tell me, do people around here really not get it about climate change? She said, it depends on who you speak to. If you speak to the Oki farmers with no more than a sixth grade education who are farming in the hills, they get it. I expected her to say the other way around. She said, they get it because they're out there seeing the changes. But if you're talking about the people who work in air-conditioned offices, they don't get it because their reality is Facebook and CNN and, you know, the shopping channels or whatever.
Good story. And I've had similar experiences when I lived in rural Ontario, Canada. I found that people were quite in touch with when the frost came and when the fire season started and all that kind of thing. So I'm going to read out a short paragraph from your website and then get your comments. Quote, at some point we realize that humanity has strayed down a rabbit hole from which it cannot seem to emerge. This quagmire is the quasi-religious belief in the Church of Consumerism, with its clergy of advertising executives, bankers and economists, corporate CEOs, politicians, and so on. End quote. Stuart, are we living in a conspiracy?
Well, first, I'm glad you picked that piece because I wrote that piece. I can own it. Various things on the website were borrowed from other sources, but that piece I wrote. Are we living in a conspiracy? I prefer to call it a complacency. There are probably individuals, corporations, who are bad actors, as we say euphemistically. They have malfeasance in mind. To them, the only thing that's important is money. Screw the next generation. That they're only concerned about themselves, even to the extent of, you know the old phrase, he'd sell his grandmother. These people would sell their children. And they are. They're selling the possibility that their children might have a full, ample life, thinking that money will protect their kids, perhaps. So aside from those bad actors, I think there are a lot of us, and I'll include myself, who don't do all we can do because we're embedded in a societal meme that's wasteful by nature. Unless you're willing to carry around a plastic fork in your backpack or your bag or your pocket, you're going to be throwing away plasticware an awful lot. That's just one small example. We keep up with the Joneses. If the Joneses are buying SUVs, we buy SUVs. So it's a very complicated situation. And I think aside from the bad actors, people want to do the right thing. But our society limits what it is we can do. So there's this complacency that's going on, I prefer to call it.
Do you subscribe to the dream that we might survive if we could convert some multi-billionaires and bankers to suddenly see reality and act quickly to avoid our common danger?
There's a certain amount in your question that makes it an absolute. And a certain amount that makes it a relative question. I'm going to deal with it as a relative question. That is, if we could convince some of the big players, if we could convince even one central banker, perhaps Mark Carney, who's the closest in my estimation to waking up, that ever-expanding economic growth at an exponential rate is not a possibility on this planet and is no longer even benefiting most people. If we could convince some of the big players of that reality, then I do think things would change. What kind of change? I think it's better to call it a softening of the impact, or perhaps a smooth landing, if that were possible. It's going to be a rather bumpy landing as currently constituted, but getting some of the big players to wake up and smell the roses, which are blooming in a much different part of the year now than they used to bloom, it's going to take some doing to do that.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest carries a blunt warning from world scientists. Stuart Scott is the force behind scientistswarning.org. Well, yeah, talking about economics, and you, way long ago, almost in another lifetime, worked with banking and with advising big business. And I've heard you talk about environmental economics and ecological economics. I don't know what either of those are or what the difference is.
If I can give an economics 101, and I'll make the disclaimer that I was not trained in economics, it's self-taught economics, but I can give a very high-level 101. The current brand of economics we have is called neoclassical economics, which is equivalent to growth economics and mainstream economics, but it's a form of economics that was put in place solidly by the very clever coup staged by J.P. Morgan back in the previous century, when he purchased, well, in polite terms, when he endowed the economics chair of the Chicago's University of Chicago School of Business. The chair summarily dismissed or through attrition let go of anyone who taught anything but neoclassical growth economics. 100 years later, in the meantime, other schools copied. Universities tend to be sheep. They follow one another. I used to ask my students of critical thinking, why the heck we still call it critical thinking when nobody uses the word critical like that anymore? It's because of the inability for institutions to break ranks and call it something else more appropriate, clear thinking. Well, once most or all of the business schools in the world were teaching neoclassical economics, why call it neoclassical? And so the coup became complete by just calling it economics. And 100 years later, few people even dream of the fact that there might be some other way to constitute an economic system. And it might not actually be so difficult to get there. Well, actually, at this point, let me differentiate. I call them simple steps that are not necessarily easy. Okay, so there are simple things we could do to get from where we are to where we need to be, but they ain't going to be easy because some people are going to have to be dragged along kicking and screaming, those bankers you talked about before. So we've got neoclassical growth economics. The model is we've got producers and consumers. The producers create the stuff that we pay them money for. The producers employ us, for which they pay us money. And, of course, there are other things involved, landlords and rents, but that's the basic model. And the main problem with that model is, when you look at it on paper, there is no concept whatsoever of an earth, of an ecosphere, that the natural resources belong outside of the market and are incorporated at zero cost, and the wastes produced by the market are thrown back into the ecosphere at no cost. So we have managed to live in a fantasy world on paper where if we need more, well, just get more. And if we start to run out of something like, the codfish fishery collapses, well, we fish something else. We rename dogfish to sea bass or something. But the point is that we cannot infinitely substitute human capital for natural capital or one kind of natural capital for another. Those are not necessarily substitutions we can make. At some point, you just run out. And right now, climate change is the most serious form of run out. We are running out of the waste sink for carbon in the atmosphere. Most of the carbon goes into the oceans once we release it into the atmosphere. And so we're acidifying the oceans, which is leading to a collapse of the marine ecosystems, the the coral reefs of the world. So it's a very complex problem, and we have not managed to educate a generation of systems thinkers. We educate people who are trained to take jobs, to take their productive place in society. So we are not a problem-solving species for the most part. So that's neoclassical growth economics. Now, environmental economics is the neoclassical economic view of the environment. That is, environmental economics says if you can put a price on the value of natural capital, and if you can price the cost of distributing your wastes into the ecosphere, then everything will work itself out in the market. This is untenable. And I give the example that one year the Japanese government put a price on the ecosystem services of all their wetlands and came up with $16 billion. This is some years ago now. Well, had they been for sale for $16 billion, they would all be built out with hotels and whatnot. There are certain things which cannot be priced. They're qualitative, not quantitative decisions that need to be made. I mean, if you think of elephants, the last elephant on Earth, his tusks will be worth an extraordinary amount of money. So the market does not have the right signals to handle things like survival of species, destruction of ecosystems. Things have to be done qualitatively, which means that governments have to step in and make laws. And right now in the United States, we have a government that is only in it for the money and not for the well-being of people or nature. And so they're dismantling the environmental laws of the last 40 and 50 years. That's environmental economics. Ecological economics takes a different worldview. It says you must recognize that the human economy exists within the biosphere, drawing its resources from the biosphere, distributing its wastes back into the biosphere. Those things cannot be escaped. And unless you take recognition of those limitations, you've got a system that won't work. So ecological economics is actually a transdisciplinary field. It's not simply a group of metrics that predict how the market will react in various conditions of interest rates. It's a transdisciplinary field that includes psychology and ecology and purer forms of economic theory. And for my money, and whenever I say that, I say, look at how it's invaded our language, how money has invaded how we think and how we talk. For my part, ecological economics or something equivalent to it is how we must go if we're going to survive.
I'm seeing more and more warnings from academics and others that the new ecological crisis will manifest in mass migration, especially from the hotter tropics. And that has already begun in Europe. Stuart, you live in Hawaii. Maybe that's a good place to be, considering how hard or expensive it is to get there.
Yes, but there's no place on Earth that's really going to be safe and the kinds of thing we're headed towards. In Hawaii, we've got the problem, especially the island I live on, the main commercial island, Oahu, where we have a 1.2 million people, and we import 95% of our food. So a dislocation in the shipping, and the shelves will go bare in a couple of days. So no place is really safe. That gets me thinking of home, and I'm 3 weeks into a trip that'll span 3.5 months, so you'll forgive me for a little bit of homesickness.
And yeah, you are a father. How do your apocalyptic warnings play out in your own home? I mean, I have to deal with this too. My kids are, I don't know if they're scarred or woke, but they certainly know what climate change is because living with us.
Yeah. How old are your kids?
Well, now they're adults. They're like 35 and...
Yeah, okay. Well, your kids may have lived through a similar experience to mine. I have two sons. One's 25, one's 27. And yes, they lived with an apocalyptic dad. I mean, I started off with Al Gore and his climate project, now Climate Reality Project. And he tends to insists that you balance hope with urgency in all your presentations. And I've moved more towards the urgency because I felt the hope was somewhat disingenuous that no number of electric vehicles or solar panels is going to bail us out of an economic system which is destroying the planet by its nature, by its growth nature. So my kids went in different directions. One of them lives in Boston and wants to have a normal life, and he rankles a little bit when the topic comes up, and it comes up all the time when I'm in conversation with strangers. So I have to kind of watch what I say around him, or he will roll his eyes and walk away from me. He wants to have a normal life, have a family, buy a house. Of course, buying a house in Boston presents a set of issues because Boston is a city at sea level. The other son stayed home in Hawaii. He just wants to be left alone to enjoy his life because he really doesn't see much purpose in trying to pursue a career. And I can't say that I fault him. So he has taken it harder than his older brother. And I just want him to be happy doing something, being productive in his own life, learning what it means to pay rent if he ever had to. Of course, we live on a very small farm property, so he just wants to take it over from me when I get too old or pass on. And God bless him. I hope he can do it. I hope he skills himself so that he can take care of the farm.
People can learn. I learned at 30, really, how to become a small-time farmer and survive doing it. Now, getting to your new website at scientistwarning.org, you offer resilience news and impact news. Briefly, what's the difference and where does that news come from?
Okay, thank you. You've studied the website very, very well. There are actually three kinds of news we offer. The first one is scientists' warning news, and that comes from the Alliance of World Scientists, but they only post news items rarely, so that news is fairly static. The other two news feeds I picked up from a group called the Environmental Health Network, EHN.org, I believe, and I came to know them through something called the Daily Climate or dailyclimate.org, and it is a news accumulator on matters concerning climate and more broadly environmental health. Things you can't separate things off into just climate. So they have stories occasionally about the ecological impacts in more general sense. So those two news feeds come from them. Impacts is more of the downside. It's more, oh my God. And resilience is more what people, communities are trying to do to adapt and to, dodge the buckshot.
And what do you want our listeners to do with your project?
Let me explain just a little bit before I give you that ask. Tell me if we're running short of time.
We are.
Okay. Well, we are trying to get an ecological movement started. The environmental movement of the past 50 years, as far as I'm concerned, did not do the trick. It was not equal to the task of changing the direction of civilization. We did not wake up. There were very limited successes. Those big green organizations are still collecting money and still trying to save the whales and et cetera, but they're not really changing policy. And they don't even get that growth economics is the problem for the most part. We are trying to create an ecological movement which sits out above, not better than, but above. It's kind of out of the plane. And we want those environmental organizations to join with us and message that all of these different individual environmental fragments of the problem are just part of a bigger whole. So we ask people to come to scientists.org and join, become a member, free membership. That is, just give us your email address. You'll get an automatic email that says, if you'd like to do more, let us know. We don't send out lots of emails. We don't spam people. We're just trying to create a union of concerned citizens of Earth. That's the way we're co-branding ourselves. We're kind of co-describing what we're doing. And if we can get a sufficient number of concerned citizens, then we are hoping to move them in certain directions with what we are developing, a wiki of best practices in use around the world by individuals and organizations. And I'll give you an example of one young girl, 15-year-old, who staged an education strike outside of the Swedish parliament and basically said to interviewers and to the parliamentarians, if you don't give a rip about my future, then I don't give a rip about your law that says I'm required to go to school. And she became internationally famous. And I'm bringing her to this year's Conference of Parties, COP24 in Poland, and we're going to do a program with she and her father. Ironically, her father's name is Svante. I said, don't I recognize that name? The family are descendants of Svante Arrhenius, the man who is credited, the scientist who's credited with discovering that CO2 would heat the planet.
6 degrees of separation. All right, I'll be watching for that on Climate Matters TV on YouTube when it comes out. And we've been talking with, of course, Stuart Scott, and he's been struggling to wake us all up. His big project now is scientistswarning.org. Stuart, thank you so much for giving us this heads up.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Alex, for what you do.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Will the Paris Climate Agreement save us from dangerous climate heating? A new study says we will reach those Paris targets for greenhouse gases not by the year 2100, but in the next 10 or 20 years. Beyond that point, getting back to a climate we can understand is difficult, if not impossible. That is partly because our actions now determine a feedback generally left out of climate models and diplomatic channels. The harsh truth is, the permafrost is thawing, and nobody knows how to stop that from happening. How will you know? Perhaps the odd news story will appear again about drunken forests or Aboriginal people with sunken homes. Pipelines will crack open, and at times they'll spill and be fixed for a while, like the highways. Then nature joins our wild heating party. Invisible plumes of carbon dioxide and methane will escape the newly thawed and now rotting Arctic carpet of soil. The new weather will astound us all. As a new study tells us, that depends on how much carbon we put into the atmosphere now and in the next few decades. We could slow down the permafrost monster or speed it up. Right now, our common human foot is firmly on the accelerator. Radio EcoShock covered permafrost science in 2012. We heard from Dr. Charles Coven from the Berkeley National Lab and Professor Antoni Lukowicz at Canada's University of Ottawa. In 2017, we got a radio update from Dr. Sarah E. Chadburn at the University of Leeds. There is a new urgency to this science we will discuss now. Our guest, Dr. Thomas Gasser, was educated in France. In 2016, he became a research scholar at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, called IIASA. That's in Europe. You'll find out what that is in a minute. Thomas Gasser is the main developer of an Earth systems model that can include positive feedbacks in our projections. That's very important. When applied to permafrost, the results are simply scary. From Austria, Thomas Gasser, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, hello.
Are you actually in the old castle in Laxenburg?
Very close by, but not in the castle itself.
It's a beautiful castle. Now, getting to our business, at the annual meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science in 2012, I recorded three talks on permafrost thaw, and the presentations, I have to tell you, were about as slow and heavy as glacier movement. It seemed from them that there was little to worry about this century. What has changed now with your research?
Actually, not so much. There's not much difference, I think, between what we knew back then and what we know now. It's more that now we have quantified the effect. So I think there are two main differences, or two new know now. The first one is that we are so close to the Paris Agreement targets, especially the 1.5, that is the long-term target of the agreement, that even a relatively slow and small effect from the permafrost feedback can significantly reduce, let's say, the chances of reaching the target. The second element is about the overshooting trajectories. That is really something that was not much discussed in the past. So the overshooting means going above the target and then trying to go back down to the target. And in this case, permafrost has a much stronger, much more important effect.
Mapping permafrost is hard. The frozen soil or rock can be shallow or deep. There are fingers and islands of frozen ground as we move south from the Arctic Circle. How do we know how much of the planet Earth is frozen and where?
So it is indeed hard to map, but there's been a lot of very important effort to do so. How we know, we proceed really step by step. So first we have to have very local observations of what is actually happening. Then we put all the local observations into databases and we try to extrapolate, or rather interpolate, this information to obtain a global map. Then this is still observation, but advanced, reconstructed observation at the global scale. And then the issue, at least that's what I dealt with, is to be able to then this time extrapolate what will happen in the future to this permafrost. So then we need the models. But initially it all comes from observations. Even if they are quite sparse at this time, we made a lot of progress compared to what we had, let's say, 10 or 20 years ago on the topic.
Thomas, talk to us about thawing permafrost as a positive feedback for climate change.
I think we have to understand what a positive feedback is, and in this case it's rather straightforward. I mean, humankind is adding greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and these are affecting the energy balance of the planet, creating this global warming, and this global warming is affecting, in turn, the permafrost layer, so this layer that is of the ground that is normally constantly frozen. This in turn, so the permafrost is thawing, and this in turn make available organic carbon for the bacteria to consume, and this consumption by bacteria actually emits more greenhouse gases. And so with more greenhouse gases, we get even more warming and even more permafrost thawing. So this is typically a positive feedback loop.
Your conclusions contain what are to me some startling possibilities. But to get there, you needed an Earth model that you helped develop. Please tell us, in layperson's language, what OSCAR is.
OSCAR is an emulator of the more complex computer models. So as I said before, we need observations to start from. We always need observations. But then, if we want to do climate change projections or to anticipate what will be the future change, be it for permafrost or the climate system in general, we need computer models that are built upon mathematical and physical laws to project the future evolution of the system. So we have these models. That's what I call the complex climate models. So they are complex in the sense that they are spatially resolved. So they represent the Earth as a grid of many, many small squares or cubes, depending on the model, and they estimate the process happening in every single of those grid cells with a very fine temporal and spatial resolution. But the problem, the drawback of having those complex models, although they are very precise models, or detailed models at least, the drawback is that they require a lot of computing time, so it can take months to have one simulation of such model on a supercalculator. Basically, to be able to explore a lot of possible futures, we need another kind of model, and this is the kind of model that OSCAR is. We need emulators that are capable of reproducing the complex model's results and then to interpolate and extrapolate them to really investigate all the possible future, even so to do simulations that the complex models cannot do.
As you know, over the years, top politicians met to discuss international climate goals. They always include a nice budget of how much carbon we can still burn and stay below the supposedly safe warming levels of 2 degrees centigrade or even 1.5 degrees C. But when they meet like that, were these world leaders informed about the true risks of permafrost thaw?
In all honesty, I don't really know. What I can tell you is that in the last IPCC report, this was included, but maybe in just one bullet point. But there is so much information in those reports, and all that information has to be summarized in a digestible way for policymakers that I cannot really tell you whether they knew or not. What I can tell you is that we scientists knew about permafrost, but back then, or at least for the last IPCC report, we couldn't really quantify the effect in terms of this budget of remaining emissions.
Right. Your new science has something to contribute to that. Now, you're working with the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, and among many nations, the Soviet Union was also a founding member of that, and that relationship continues now with Russia. My question is, did you have access to Russian data on permafrost thaw, to Russian scientists, or to their projections?
I did not directly use this kind of data. So, as I said, I basically integrated knowledge from other models, but those models, the complex models, they are based on a compilation of data, of observation, of permafrost, and I know for sure that in this data there is, well, a lot coming from the Russian Federation.
Now, we want your study results, but they're not so simple. Thomas, why is there such a wide range of values to each emission pathway that you checked out?
So there are many reasons, or at least several. The first one, and maybe in a sense the most important, is that despite all the improvement in the past about what we know on permafrost, there is still a huge, huge uncertainty and a huge knowledge gap. This is mostly because this is a slow process, and in the recent past, it did not happen so much. So we basically lack the data to further constrain the models. So without good observations, basically the models, they are worthless. But that's not the only reason. Another reason is that this concept of emission budget, that is, how much we can emit before reaching a given global temperature change, although it seems very simple, it is actually quite difficult to estimate, and there are a lot of methodological uncertainties behind the simple concept. So part of the uncertainty is not because we don't know what's happening, it's because, I would say, of the caveat of the concept itself.
So if we take the low end of your projections and we include the permafrost loop that you studied, what is the best we can hope for?
I think the best case scenario is, as you said earlier, that the process will be so slow that it will barely affect us in the coming century.
All right. And what about the worst of your projections? What's that look like if the permafrost feedback really kicks in?
So in the worst case, I would distinguish two subcases, actually. So the first one is that we do everything we can to actually meet the Paris Agreement targets, but the permafrost feedback is quite strong, and in this case, we would, well, part of our efforts would be cancelled. So we would maybe not end up at 1.5, but at 1.7 or 1.8. The second subcase is maybe more interesting, is in the sense, widely scientifically speaking, if we do not make that much effort and we really plan to do this overshoot, and for instance, if we first reach 3 degrees of warming, but then we want to go back to 1.5, this overshoot will really trigger a lot of permafrost thawing, and then we would have to more than double our effort to go back to this 1.5. So this non-linear behavior that we really put forward in our study is, I think, really the key result here.
Radio EcoShock.
You are listening to the weekly base science program, Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from Austria. My guest is Dr. Thomas Gasser, a research scientist for the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, and we're talking about thawing permafrost. Here on Radio EcoShock, Dr. Kevin Anderson from the UK's Tyndall Centre warned that all the climate pathways developed by the IPCC depend on a technology that does not exist now, large-scale carbon capture and storage. Do you think that technology should be part of our plans to keep a livable climate?
Well, the answer from the scientist is that relying on this is risky, but can make some sense, in which case we should strongly increase our efforts to actually develop the technology. Then the citizen believes that it's completely crazy.
Are we sure the permafrost is thawing? How do we know?
Well, we have two ways, I would say. First, we know locally, this is pretty obvious, it one just needs to go there and to observe it, in the sense that local populations spend their life there. They can see it. We can see the ground thawing. Infrastructures that were previously built on solid ground are collapsing. But we also know it from a more global perspective, thanks to large-scale observations, be it through flux monitoring networks, so towers that are able to observe the flux of greenhouse gases that is released by this permafrost, but also through satellite images.
Is it possible to say how much carbon will be added to our atmosphere from thawing permafrost, or does that all depend on how much carbon we humans keep adding to the atmosphere?
Well, it firstly depends on how much we will be adding.
When I'm reading your paper or talking with other scientists, the talk goes to petagrams of carbon, each petagram being a billion metric tons. But here in the public, we're told about parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. Is there an easy way to understand that relationship or to convert from one to the other?
Well, the conversion is not straightforward. This is because of what we call the carbon cycle. So when carbon goes to the atmosphere, it then enters the natural carbon cycle. For instance, part of this carbon is taken up by the ocean. So part of it is diluted in the ocean and then transported around the globe. But also part of it is removed by the terrestrial biosphere. So to actually know how much in the end from one petagram of carbon you will add in terms of net effect to the atmosphere, it's necessary to account for this carbon cycle and to quantify it. And again, that's why we need those models, not only climate models, but also carbon cycle models. And that's why I use this OSCAR model, which is an emulator of more complex carbon cycle models.
Did you also study releases of methane from organic material in this long frozen soil?
This is included in this study. However, this is something that is even more uncertain. So what we did, we simply calculated this effect as a proportion, like a constant proportion of the CO2 effect, at least in terms of emissions. So when there is one petagram of carbon emitted, we assumed that 2.3% was emitted as CH4 and the remainder as CO2. And then we also have a modeling of the atmospheric cycle of methane, that the atmospheric chemistry of methane is also affecting the whole Earth system.
And what about methane in the seabed below warming seas? Does that matter?
I cannot answer to the question. I mean, this is frontier research right now. I am involved in a project in which we will try to estimate and, in a sense, redo the calculations with integration of the sea seabed permafrost. So this is something that is already missing in our study.
We'll look forward to that. Now, Thomas, suppose we miraculously manage to control emissions by 2035, and then we go down to zero emissions later in this century. Would the permafrost stop thawing and emitting greenhouse gases, or would it reach a stable point where it rests, or does it just keep on going?
I will say that our current knowledge tells us that it would stop at some point. Basically, if we really stop all emissions, we will reach some equilibrium temperature, and the permafrost feedback would just add a certain relatively small percentage to this equilibrium temperature. But in all honesty, we are not 100% sure of that, and there's still a lot about the system that we don't fully understand, so there may be some more feedbacks within the whole Earth system.
And once that permafrost thaws, it's pretty difficult, I would think, to refreeze the ground. Can you imagine a geoengineering technology which could refreeze the ground in the far north once it thaws?
Personally, I cannot imagine such a technology, but I'm sure some people actually can. So then the question, as with any geoengineering technique, is both. Is it actually feasible in terms of technology? But then there is also this moral issue behind geoengineering, and is it the right solution to intervene on the climate system? And aren't we going to do more harm than good?
We have had serious scientists on this program who think we will hit 3 degrees C of global mean warming this century. What do you think, what happens to the permafrost feedback we've been discussing if we go over 3 degrees C? Do we know?
Well, I cannot give the exact value, but roughly speaking, I would say we would end up at 3.4 instead of 3 because of the feedback.
Your paper says, quote, "It is key to foster observation and model-based research on the permafrost and other tipping processes of the Earth system, so as to know if and when the world will enter an overshooting climatic regime." Thomas, that almost seems to say to me we could go past a tipping point and not know it, or we could have already passed one and don't realize it yet.
Unfortunately, it is possible. We just don't know. I mean, it's we really need a lot more information, and that's why there is observation-based research is important. And then the modeling of all those tipping systems is also important. To me, it seems we are barely scratching the surface of this question. Unfortunately, it seems already too late to inform the political debate. But yeah, scientifically speaking, there's still a lot of work to be done on this topic.
The funding of your new paper with the 8 other scientists comes what seems to me from a strange place. It's a project investigating the role of phosphorus called Imbalance P. What is that imbalance and why does it matter?
Yes, so this is the main founder. This is a European project. And there is actually a link with phosphorus in the sense that, as I said, in permafrost, there is organic matter, organic material, and this contains a lot of carbon, but not only carbon. It contains nitrogen and some phosphorus. So this Imbalance P project is about understanding the global phosphorus cycle and how it interacts with the carbon cycle and the nitrogen cycle. And just we wanted to include this permafrost thawing process to then, in the next step, also include in our model the nitrogen and phosphorus cycles to see how those all those processes can interact.
Well, I think that's the subject of another interview, because really it sounds like the project is looking into what we could call peak phosphorus, and we need phosphorus for agricultural uses. It's a giant subject about what happens to the earth with phosphorus.
Yes, it is. So, but I would distinguish two aspects. There is this peak phosphorus issue that is more related to the anthropogenic part of the system. But we also know that the natural phosphorus cycle, although it is disturbed by human activities, we know it's also quite crucial for the carbon cycle. So basically, as I said earlier, the terrestrial biosphere, so the plants, roughly speaking, they actually remove CO2 from the atmosphere. And we know that tropical forests, especially in Amazonian basin, they are limited in phosphorus. So understanding how the future phosphorus cycle will behave helps understanding how the future carbon cycle will behave, and therefore climate change.
Thomas, I enjoy discussing climate science, and as a Canadian, I've heard about permafrost all my life, but now I'm afraid of it. I have this fear of thawing right up there with the dread of our fossil fuel burning. Should I be so worried, and are you?
Well, maybe I can just answer for myself, but spending my time working on the topic makes me, in a sense, less worried, or I have just maybe accepted what is probably going to happen. Then I believe the global picture is worrying. Then, I don't have any more answers than anyone else in the end.
We have been speaking with Dr. Thomas Gasser. He's a research scientist for the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, funded by many countries with headquarters in Austria. Thomas is the lead author of Path-Dependent Reductions in CO2 Emission Budgets Caused by Permafrost Carbon Release. That was published in the journal Nature Geoscience on September 17, 2018. You can find links to all this in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thomas, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Well, thank you for this opportunity to explain my work.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Well, aside from what we have just learned from this new research, my own opinion remains darker when it comes to the Great Thaw. It is literally a geologic event unfolding, apparently within a few generations or less. The Arctic has warmed more than anywhere else on Earth. It's astounding, the heating that's up there. And as Dr. Gasser told us, the true burden of methane under the sea and projections about that release are uncounted and unknown. That's all for Radio EcoShock this week. Thank you for listening and for caring about our world.